Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Simone Rios in for Tiziana Deering. We're only two games into the NBA Finals, and already we've experienced the thrill of victory in Game 1.
Brown inside. Horford with the offensive rebound. Wide open, Smart. Cash! And the Celtics have stormed ahead.
But we've also felt the agony of defeat in Game 2.
Golden State has a lot of time. Poole with the ball. Launches.
And that one was from about 40 feet away from the hoop. So what will Game 3 bring tomorrow night? And do the Celtics have what it takes to bring home a title? Here to help us answer those questions is NBC Sports Celtics sideline reporter Abby Chin. Abby, welcome to Radio Boston.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So general thoughts. What do you make of this series so far?
It's been fun. And exciting. Being out in San Francisco and inside Chase Center for those two games was thrilling, particularly in the fourth quarter of Game 1 when the Celtics took over and that crowd. And it felt like everyone inside the arena was just in shock. That one was really fun. Game 2, like you mentioned, not nearly as much fun for those of us who have been following the Celtics all season. But I do think it showed, and maybe even surprising a lot of people, that the Celtics do have a team to beat in this series.
Right. So, as you said, Game 1, they looked amazing. Game 2, it was like, what happened? And that's sort of how this entire playoff run has been, right? What's up with that? Are they just inconsistent? Are they still young and learning how to compete at this level?
Yeah, I think that's it. This has, like you said, been part of their entire playoff run. It has also, I mean, was a big part of their struggles earlier in the season. This is a team that has overcome so much adversity throughout the year, and they really found something through the second half and the back half of the season. And then once they got to the playoffs, some of those old habits started to rear their head. They always figure it out, and once their backs are up against the wall, they have come through, just like we saw in the two previous series. They've won in Game 7s. But yes, this team, and they talk about it all the time, so it is maddening that they can't fix it. But they struggle with success. Coming off of wins, they've had some of their worst games, particularly Game 6 in the Eastern Conference Finals against Miami. I don't think there's any question that they started hearing all that talk, everyone anointing this group, saying they were already into the NBA Finals. Yeah. And so they came out and did not play well in Game 6, but then took care of business in Game 7.
That's right. Well, hopefully they can pick up where they left off there. But injuries have been a big factor. Celtics big man Robert Williams has had knee problems. He looked great in Game 1, then pretty limited in Game 2. What do you expect from him tomorrow night in Game 3? How important will he be to this team?
He is very important to this team and what they like to do defensively, especially against this quick-footed Warriors team. Unfortunately, I agree with you, he did not look like himself in Game 2, and that is disappointing considering the Celtics had 2 days off. The hope was to get Rob even more rest. When I spoke with him the day before the game, he said he was feeling good. I am concerned because the long flight back across the country, typically the planes and being crunched up. I mean, yes, the Celtics are flying on a charter, they're first class seats. It's not like he's back in coach.
Not like the rest of us.
Right, exactly. With the rest of us. We're taking red eyes overnight. But he is... there's no question that time spent on that airplane and has not helped with some of the swelling and some of the pain issues that he's been dealing with. It was a surgically repaired knee on a partially torn meniscus, and then he got a bone bruise as well in that series against Milwaukee when he came back. So it is something that is going to be an issue throughout these playoffs, and I agree with you. He did not look right in Game 2, and I'm not hopeful for Game 3, actually, coming off the plane. Maybe in Game 4, we'll start to see the Time Lord as we know him.
Okay, I'll be looking for that. So, everybody's talking about Draymond Green here in Boston, and I'm sure everywhere else in the country, in the world, where they watch basketball, the Warriors' big man. He said a different type of tone in Game 2. Talked a lot of trash, a lot of shenanigans, I want to call them. At one point, he tackled Grant Williams, and then Williams was somehow called for that foul. Then he kind of dropped Jaylen Brown as Brown was shooting a three, and then placed his feet on Brown's head, and then tried to pull his pants down and didn't get a technical. Do you expect to see more of that tomorrow night?
I do, because it worked in game two for him. And what the Celtics players said after game two was that, that's Draymond. We know what he's trying to do. This is not something that we didn't expect. It's something that they have to, and it goes back to what you said, the consistency and showing your maturity. They have to move on from that and be able to overcome it. The Warriors players did say, though, that that was inspiring to them. There's no question there was a raised level of intensity from the Warriors from game one to game two. And the Celtics are going to have to match that if they want to win in this series. But I agree with you. I was completely frustrated by Draymond Green. And the worst part of it is that he got called for a technical in the first quarter. And in the NBA, if you get called for two techs in the same game, you're out. And Draymond knew that these referees on this stage in those moments were not going to call him for a second tech and eject him for that. So he basically, it felt like, had free reign to do whatever he wanted. And that's when those other instances you mentioned occurred. So we will see how the refs adjust to that in game three, if he is allowed that much leeway. And it's pretty frustrating that he was asked about it post game and Draymond said, I've earned that leeway. And that's frustrating to feel like he can do whatever he wants. That doesn't seem right.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of people have been talking about what Mark Jackson and Jeff Van Gundy were saying as former ref Steve Jaffe was talking about the situation. Let's hear what they had to say.
Well, Steve, my question to you is, as a referee over there in the huddle, are you thinking about the fact that Draymond has one technical already?
Absolutely. I think that's part of good officiating is the fact that you have to know who has the technical fouls. And in this situation, one of the players does. Is this enough to warrant an ejection is what you have to think about.
Okay, so we can complain about the refs and Draymond as much as we want. But at the end of the day, the Celtics need to be held accountable here. I mean, if this were the Larry Bird, Kevin McHale, Robert Parrish Celtics of the 80s, I think they'd have no problem going toe-to-toe with somebody like Draymond. I won't mention Kevin McHale clotheslining Kurt Rambis in the 84 NBA Finals, but what should the C's do to tackle this major problem?
That was an iconic moment. I would say that we have seen the Celtics are not afraid to play physical. We saw it against Giannis and the Bucks in their series, and we saw it against Miami. That was just a grind it out, smash mouth basketball series. And so there's no question the Celtics can reach that level. It is something that head coach Ime Udoka has hearkened on from the moment he took the job, and that is just that this group has some bad habits. And one of those habits is arguing with the officials, not moving on from play to play, and then allowing that frustration to boil over. And so then if shots aren't falling, and then your defense struggles. So yes, the Celtics need to overcome those things. They can't let Draymond's antics get to them. And while they know that it's coming, it certainly is a different matter when you're in the heat of the battle, but that is where that maturity will shine through. And it is, you're right, it's up to them.
I wonder too if the team's leaders, and I'm looking at Al Horford and Marcus Smart, if they need to maybe unify their message a little bit. You know, as I understand it, one was more the talking about the sword, pulling out the sword in response to Draymond, and the other one was saying turn the other cheek. Do they need to kind of get together for a leadership meeting and figure out how they want to lead this team?
That is something that has been very unique and special about this team this season, I would say. Marcus Smart had his comments all the way back in November calling out the Jays, saying that they weren't passing enough. And from that moment on, this group has really come together and held each other accountable. No one is afraid to speak up and speak their mind and stand up in those moments. And it has been a challenge from Ime Udoka to an Al Horford, who is not necessarily a rah-rah, big yelling guy to speak up more. We know Marcus Smart will do that. But also it's on Jaylen and Jason to speak up and deliver a message as well and deliver a calming force. So yes, I agree the message will be unified. the message needs to be unified. I have no question that it will be here going forward in game three, especially from the top down and head coach Ime Udoka, and then from Al and Marcus and everybody.
Abby Chin, you've been a basketball reporter for some time, and that grants you all kinds of access to these players that most of us watch on TV. What do you think of the team's dynamic at this point in time? What player are you looking to really make the difference, to be the X factor in these finals?
The X factor, to me, still and is always going to be Jason Tatum. He has not had his best game. We saw in game one, he was phenomenal as a playmaker with those dishing out 13 assists and passing out of the double teams. But the Warriors made adjustments and they made it tougher for him in game two. And so to me, the way that Jason goes is the way that these Celtics go. I don't know if that's an X factor per se, but I think, you know, unfortunately, because this is the task that he has asked for, it is a challenge that he welcomes, but it's up to Jason Tatum to star and outshine. We've seen Steph Curry carry the Warriors for long stretches of these games. And so it is going to be, I think this is the final step in Jason Tatum's official ascension to superstardom in the NBA.
Okay, well, I wish him the best of luck on that front. That's NBC Sports Celtics sideline reporter Abby Chin. Abby, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Simone Rios. This is Radio Boston. The sun's out. Weather's warm, and that means a perfect chance to enjoy a bite outdoors. What you might not know is that most of the food on your plate would not be possible without pollinators, like bees. 3 out of 4 crops we eat rely on bees to spread pollen and help them grow. That's where Bees and Thank You comes in, a local food truck business that hopes to spread the word about the role of bees in our local ecology and our diets. They're on a mission to serve grilled cheese to save the bees. You heard it. Grilled cheese to save the bees. We're joined by Nick Lorenza, a Haverhill native and co-founder of Bees and Thank You. Welcome, Nick.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So grilled cheese for bees definitely has a ring to it.
Absolutely.
Tell us about how you made the connection between grilled cheese sandwiches and bee conservation.
So it's actually a really funny story. Our co-founder, Ryan, he was working in the dining halls at Emmanuel College, and every time there was grilled cheese night, there would be a line of 100 people out the door. And, you know, we started talking. We were like, oh, this is maybe something we could do. You know, we started messing around with recipes. One day he was at his house just making a grilled cheese. He decided to put some honey on it. And at the same time, a bee flew in the window and landed on the grilled cheese. He took a cup and put it over the grilled cheese. We actually have a video of this, too. Mm. It's pretty funny. He walked over to the window and then let the bee out, and the caption was, "Save the bees, eat grilled cheese," and that's kind of how we got started.
So a real revelation, a message from above. You knew you had to do something.
Exactly.
And it's quite a menu. So the sandwiches are served on Texas toast with your choice of American or buffalo wing cheddar cheeses, or a vegan option with shredded non-dairy cheeses. And crucially, every sandwich comes with raw organic wildflower and clover honey, which we'll get to try later. Locally sourced from apiaries that you partner with. Sounds amazing, but how do people react to this flavor combination?
A lot of people have never tried it before or just never thought to try it before. And I'm honestly blown away by people's reaction to it. Like, we have people who come back year after year. They've been like, I've been waiting since last year to have this grilled cheese. Like, we've had people who say the grilled cheese has changed their life. It's awesome. I love people's reaction to it.
So tell me what was going through your minds when you started this food truck business. I mean, you gave us that great story about the bee on the grilled cheese sandwich, but then you came to a real social impact kind of analysis. How did you get there?
So like I was saying, Ryan, who was at Emmanuel College, he was studying about Sister Dorothy Stang, who gave her life for rainforest conservation. And at the same time, I was at UMass Boston, and I had a professor who was really into nonprofits and B corporations and how B corporations can benefit the communities in which they operate and do more than just provide value to their shareholders. And by doing so, they actually give more value to their customers. And I truly believe that going forward, people are only going to want to support businesses that do certain initiatives like we are.
Well, it almost sounds like a match made in heaven, a B corporation for a B.
Exactly. We're a true B corporation.
I like it. They should brand that on the top of their website somewhere. Also joining us today is the state's go-to authority on bees, Kim Skirm from the Mass Department of Agriculture, to help us understand more on this issue. Welcome, Kim.
Well, thank you so much for having me today. What a great group. What a fun topic.
Indeed. So this kind of work really hits on a fundamental issue we're facing and that we, or I, rarely hear about, and that's the state of bees. Kim Skirm, you're the top official in Massachusetts on bee business. For people who might not know about bees, can you share with us a little bit about their role as pollinators and why they're so important to our ecology and our food?
Yes, definitely. Bees are literally the bee's knees for the ecosystem. So the services that bees provide are unmatched. And what are we talking about when we say services? Well, we've got pollination, which is critical for our plants. And then also in that process, they also assist in soil erosion, carbon sequestration, so we have clean air, and then actually for habitat for wildlife, and in addition to as part of the food chain. So, and I'll put a few numbers to it so people can get an idea of what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. So between 75 to 95% of the world's plant populations, that's 180,000 plant species, rely on pollinators for survival and for habitat and for those pieces that I just mentioned. And you mentioned earlier about crop production, 80% of our agricultural crops that are grown in the world, that's 1,200 different plant species that are grown that we love to eat as part of our food supply, rely on pollinators. So they are extremely critical.
Yeah, and those pollinators, is it primarily bees? Are there other creatures doing this great job as well?
Yeah, so bees are, I think, probably the most charismatic of the group and what we sort of consider as the keystone for their species. But we also have a lot of other insects that are pollinating, beetles and butterflies and wasps and moths and flies. And we, of course, have other animals that are pollinating, like hummingbirds, for instance. So there's a kind of a myriad of different pollinating groups out there. But bees have sort of become the poster child for this particular group.
Okay. So bring us home to Massachusetts. These are global issues, and it's something we've been dealing with as a country for a long time. What's the state of the bee population here in Massachusetts?
Well, we've actually got a really amazing group of beekeepers that manage our honeybees here in Mass and in New England as a whole. So without those folks managing bees, we would have very low populations of honeybees because they are and need management. Every year, we're losing anywhere between 30 to 50% of our honeybee colonies through the winter, through the season. This past year, we've actually had a record overwintering success, much lower than our average. And so we're really excited about that. And that has actually been seen across the board in the nation and actually in our friends in Canada to the north. So whatever happened last year in our weather, COVID, maybe people paying more attention to their bees or getting interested in this really shifted the survival. So, but overall, bees are, of course, honeybees particularly still struggle from a variety of stressors. A lot of researchers will call them the four P's. So that includes parasites, pathogens, pesticides, and poor nutrition, which is part of habitat loss and decline in forage quality for bees.
Wow. Okay. So a lot to take in there. Nick Lorenzi, I want to get back to you. So on top of grilled cheese and honey, which sounds delicious, I understand that you're running this initiative called Seeds for Bees. What's your goal in sharing seeds with your customers?
So basically, this just gives people a way that they can help in their own backyard, in their local community, and it really piques people's interest in learning about the problem. The biggest issue we run into is people don't even know this is a problem. Your average person doesn't even know that bees are dying or that pollinators are important. So one of the biggest things we do when we go around is try to educate people. And by giving them these seed packets whenever they buy anything or just whenever they want them, anyone who comes up can come get them. We've given out over 200,000 seed packets throughout the years from just traveling around to different fairs and music festivals.
And what are folks planting?
So we have different regiments for different times of the year, and they're all native plants to New England in different parts of New England. Like, one of the biggest things we tell people is, you know, you got to stop buying the plants from Home Depot and Lowe's, and you got to get the native plants from either a local nursery or you can do some research yourself and find the seeds online from a reputable dealer.
Okay, so the idea is help people plant these beautiful plants that the bees and the other insects that play this important pollinating role can feast on.
Yeah, we really want to get people gardening more because that will be the real solution for giving the pollinators a proper environment and food source and returning to the native plants that they were used to when they came over here.
Okay, point well taken. Kim, back to you. Along with planting these seeds, what easy steps can folks here in the Boston area and Massachusetts, what can we do to help the bee population from where we live?
Well, the thing that is the critical consider when to help bees is that you need to view your landscape, your yard, your back porch, your front porch, whatever area you have. You need to view it with a bee's eye, really a bee's eye view. Mm. And so you need to look at it from the way that they're going to see that, which is from a habitat perspective. So where can they nest? What can they eat in your yard? Where can they get sources of water? Where can they overwinter? Where can they mate? Those are the things you need to consider because they're going to view your yard, your flower pot in that way. And so it's a matter of not only planting flowers, and I totally agree. I think natives are a fantastic way to incorporate that in your area, but also viewing your landscape with that bee's eye view from reducing the mowing of your lawn. And some people are going, are you kidding me? I'm not going to reduce the mowing of my lawn, but it's critical. Actually, a study from the UMass researchers in Springfield, Massachusetts in 2018 found that if they reduced lawn mowing to every 2 weeks, you actually had a greater bee abundance. And if you reduced it even further every 3 weeks, guess what? We had a greater bee diversity. So the numbers of bees not only increased, but the amount of different species increased. That's something really teeny. I'm sure most folks would probably not argue if you told them to not mow their grasses often. So it might be a really easy one to do. And then my last tip is to reduce the amount of mulch that we put in our yards. And most people really love mulch in New England. It's a great way for us to help with the habitat we're creating in our yard. But if we leave some bare ground, be mindful that 90% of our bee species in Massachusetts, we have 400 different species. Wow. 90% of those are solitary. And of those, the majority of them nest in the ground, and they cannot nest if there's mulch covering those areas for them. So leave a little bare ground in your yard. That's a big one for bees. And then the last kind of key point is to make sure you can reduce as much as possible your use or reliance on pesticides. If you can incorporate an integrated pest management approach where you're using a lot of different tools in your toolbox, it's a much better way to go about managing your landscape in your yard.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'll definitely keep that in mind next time I'm thinking about mowing my lawn, that it actually might not be in the best interest of our bee population for me to do it with great frequency. I know the state is also working with citizen scientists on bee preservation. How can ordinary people get involved in that?
So we actually work a lot with beekeepers, and we take a lot of data for surveys on bee health. But so beekeeper aspect, definitely check out our webpage, the MDAR apiary program. Now, for folks who may not be keeping bees, you can check out the iNaturalist website, especially if you're really keen on walking around your yard and observing what pollinators are visiting the flowers. That's a great website to be able to capture some photos and document what species are there. We really need more data about the amount and diversity of bees that are in our area. We assume we have about 400 different species, but you know, the distribution of those and if some of those are in decline is critical to be able to document that. And then for the educators that are listening, we are I've actually partnered with the Massachusetts Ag in the Classroom group and have been offering kits for teachers to be able to put sunflowers in, plant the sunflowers with the students. And then you can actually combine that with the Great Sunflower Project, which is a national effort to document the species of bees that come to sunflowers. So really fun ways to get involved.
Yeah, wonderful work. So unfortunately, you're not here to join us for this next part, but Nick Lorenza, there's local honey on every sandwich that your company offers. And we're going to try some right now.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man.
Sorry, Kim. Tell me about this. I have a plate in the middle of the studio. Looks like there's two types of honey.
Yep.
And some spoons. Tell me what we're looking at.
So these are the honeys that we put on the sandwiches, and these are also the honeys that we offer in our subscription service. We have a creamed honey from up in Maine right here, and then we have a liquid raw honey from the Essex County right there.
So these are both two local varieties that you can get as members of your program?
Yes, the Be Well box.
Okay. So what should I look out for? The one of them looks a little more clear, and then the other ones look maybe a little more cloudy. Is that the whipped honey?
Yeah, so when you whip the honey, it basically makes the crystals more dense, which gives you a more rich and sweeter taste. So you'll definitely be able to taste the difference. I'd start with the liquid one right there.
Okay, are you going to join me here?
Yeah.
A couple absolutely. Spoons liquid honey.
Yeah, after you.
It's looking pretty,
cheers.
Pretty scrumptious. Thank you.
So yeah, you can really taste all the flowers and everything, all the secondary sources of the pollen in that one. All the honey comes straight from the hives. We don't filter it or anything.
What a gift. What a gift they have for us.
Yep.
Those bees. I'm dripping it all over my
me too.
Papers here.
Making a little
I better
mess.
Eat it all. All right.
So yeah, move on to
that
the
was excellent.
One over here.
Okay.
So this one's from up in Maine. You'll definitely notice a much sweeter, and it almost makes your mouth tingle when it hits it.
Sweeter than the last one, huh?
Yeah.
That's kind of hard to believe. Okay. It looks creamy like... almost like dulce de leche
we
eat in South America. Let's see here. Wow.
Yeah, if you've never tried the creamed honey before, it's definitely an experience.
Delectable.
Yeah, right? It's completely different.
So where can I get this stuff? How do I sign up?
So our website is bewellbox.com.
Okay.
And we partner with the local apiaries from all over New England, and then we ship the local honey directly to your door. And the same thing with the grilled cheese. All the proceeds help us to further our education and bee conservation efforts.
Well, that was just excellent, Nick. Thank you so much for coming in. That's Nick Lorenza, co-founder of Bees, and thank you. Listeners, we'll have all their information at the Radio Boston website. Thank you, Nick.
Thanks for having us.
And Kim Skirm, state apiarist at the Massachusetts Department of Agriculture. Thank you, Kim.
Thanks so much, everybody. This was a true treat.
Indeed. One more thing. Later this week on Radio Boston, we're talking veggies and lawn care with expert gardener Patrick Parent of Mahoney's Garden Center. We may have some bee-centric questions for him. We know you've got questions on everything from what to plant next to how to care for your tomato plants in a drought. Send us your questions in our texting group. If you're already a member, text us your questions today. If you're not, text the word Boston to 617-766-0382 to get started. That's the word Boston to 617-766-0382. We'll go out with a little Honeybee by blues guitarist Albert King. This is Radio Boston. Video games and schoolwork are two things that don't usually go hand in hand, but for a group of high schoolers in Dorchester, gaming is the assignment. As WBUR's Carrie Young reports, the program is playing an unexpected role in re-engaging students in school after pandemic disruption.
So just treat these buttons like arrow keys. Like
I'm at the Dearborn STEM Academy, and a group of students have just handed me a laptop so that I can play a video game they recently made.
Pressing play.
The game opens with a short animation.
Hello? Are you ready? I'm outside.
On the screen are two students who have missed their bus for a field trip. They try to catch up in their own car, but then the car crashes. 16-year-old Edson Miranda explains the player is left alone in the dark, trying to find her friend.
And, like, you're mostly just moving around through the forest.
Miranda says he loves watching other people play a game that he and several other students helped to make. He adds the process was also fun, which is exactly what his teachers at the Dearborn were hoping for.
They're learning how to use a computer to augment their creative process, to push themselves further in their creative endeavors. And that will create kids who start to self-actualize in the machine.
John Laporto is a computer science teacher at the school. He explains that students are learning about more than just computer science with this project. The teachers here have built game design into multiple different subject areas, from art to English. Greg Nelson, the English language arts teacher, helps students create interesting plot lines for their games.
Your game can only be as strong as the story
on which it's developed.
There's a civics component too. Social studies teacher Melissa Mungonia-Tiffany helps her students understand the cultural biases built into many of today's video games. She pushes her students to think of ways to diversify who we see featured in games.
We encourage our students to look at different identities, ones they're a part of, do interviews with people of different identities to figure out how they'd like to be represented in video games.
Computer science teacher John Laporto helped create the program shortly before the pandemic. But like many aspects of life, the effort got a bit hamstrung by COVID. All of the group work was just hard to do when school went remote and student engagement tanked. But when class schedules returned to normal this year, the video game project was an unexpected game changer.
There was that feeling of you're still part of something.
He thinks the students leveled up their engagement in part because they made personal connections in their project groups.
If you don't show up and they're looking for some asset that needs to be put in the game, or they're looking for this audio file for whatever, you know, they need you.
17-year-old Miguel Tavares agrees. He liked how supportive his classmates were this year.
When you work with people, like, it's easier to get things done. When you're working with someone, you got someone to help you, like, support you.
English teacher Greg Nelson says this program also brought instructors closer together because they had to coordinate their lessons.
We're all coming back next year, and that is not the case across the district, but this team depends on one another.
Nelson says just like his students, he's learning how much teamwork can make any effort easier.
That report from WBUR's Carrie Young. It's Tuesday, folks. Arguably the most nondescript day of the week. It's not Monday. It's not almost the weekend. It's not even Wednesday, hump day. But what if you were almost done with the week? What if you only worked 4 days a week? Sounds nice. The movement for a four-day work week first emerged in the 1970s, then fizzled out until, of course, COVID. Remote work being always on, long hours, and a stressful world has a lot of us asking ourselves, why are we doing this? Now, for some folks, working only 4 days a week might be the answer. Just yesterday, the New York Times reported that 70 companies in the UK started a four-day work week pilot program. Similar proposals have been floated in Japan and for private companies in New Zealand. And in 2021, Spain and Iceland conducted nationwide four-day work week experiments to overwhelming success. And right here in Massachusetts, as of this month, city employees in Swampscott, Massachusetts, are permanently working 4 days a week. Joining us now in the studio is Sean Fitzgerald, town administrator in Swampscott. Welcome.
Thank you, Simone. Really a pleasure to be here.
So let's be clear. Folks in your town still work 40 hours a week, just over 4 days. Is that right?
We actually work 34 hours a week, and we work that over 4 days.
So gotcha.
We haven't changed the hours. We've just reallocated those hours over those 4 days to ensure that we really do provide a needed break for many of our staff.
So give me the schedule, for example. Does everybody have the same schedule? What does that look like?
You know, we actually, you know, just like every city and town, we have firefighters that work 24 on, 24 off.
Sure.
24 on, 5 days off. Police officers work a very challenging schedule. You know, they, like many police departments, have been called in and had to deal with an enormous burden through the pandemic. Town hall staff, like many you know, municipalities, we work a schedule 8 to 5 on Monday, mm-hmm. Tuesday, and 8 to 7 on Wednesday, and 8 to 5 on Thursday. And so by shifting our hours, we actually previously worked 8 to 12 on a Friday. By closing town hall on a Friday, we shifted some additional hours on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. And being open a little bit later on Wednesday allows some residents to pop in that may never have had that time.
Okay. So you piloted this four-day work week for your employees at Swampscott Town Hall back in May, and you found it was so successful that you decided to make it permanent. What worked about it?
You know, a lot worked about it. First, you know, I received a lot of really terrific support from town residents and my elected officials. A lot of folks have realized that, you know, we've been able to accomplish quite a bit over the last few years, even through the pandemic. But it was taking a toll. You know, we had, just like a number of organizations, seen a number of resignations that really affected our continuity, and really looking at how do we create an environment that really helps our staff stay energized, stay inspired. You know, we're in public service, and we want to really create an environment that elicits the best out of people. And in the night meetings and the Zoom meetings that bleed into work and home, you know, it all started to take a toll.
Yeah. So you had a lot of resignations, and this was in part a response to that. You realized your staff needed a better work-life balance.
Absolutely. You know, we have a number of young families. You know, we have parents that were trying to make it all work, and frankly, it just wasn't always possible. And we recognized that, you know, it would be important for us to change something. And so we put a committee together, and we looked at a few things. It was clear at the top of the list was we need more time in the weekend. We need more time to take care of our families as you know, we take care of the community. And that really resonated with me.
Yeah, absolutely. And what's the, you know, what's your staff saying now? Has it already made a difference in their lives?
It has. And I, you know, the first couple of weeks I would come in and say, hey, I just spent your Friday. How was your weekend? And I would hear just these wonderful stories of spending more time with their children, going to a beach or going to a park or, you know, spending time with terminally ill parents. And to me, these examples really helped me believe that this is something that we should put in place for the long term. You know, we're in public service to help people, and it's critically important that we help our staff that are out there helping everybody else.
I want to ask you, everybody wants to know about government efficiency, that taxpayer dollars are being spent wisely. So are you seeing the same level of efficiency with people working less hours, or is there greater efficiency?
Yeah, it's a great question, Simone. I you know, Swampscott is one of Massachusetts' 351 cities and towns. Over the last 5 years, we've had one of the slowest growths in the average single-family tax bill. In fact, for 4 years, we didn't have an increase. And so we look at metrics that help us define, you know, are we, you know, really achieving, you know, that broader goal in our master plan? Are we looking at things that can help us define solid economic development and creation of open space and managing our educational priorities? And Swampscott really is checking the box on all these fronts. And we've been able to really do much, but it has taken a toll. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important for us to really look at, you know, how much, you know, productivity are we getting out of that Friday, as opposed to, you know, can we recharge our staff over the 3-day weekend? Can we give them more time to really feel like they're meeting other needs, so that when they come back to work on a Monday and, you know, contribute to their passion of public service, you know, they're more optimally supported.
Sean, you're Swampscott's town manager. That's a very
town
demanding.
Town administrator.
I'm sorry, town administrator. That's a demanding job, regardless of the title. Does this apply to you as well? Are you working 4 days a week, or?
You know, I've worked each of these Fridays, and I've found it to be very helpful. At this point, you know, I'm really doing my best to transition. We're in the busiest time of year. This is our annual town meeting time, and you know, we're having a special town meeting next week to possibly acquire a waterfront piece of property. And so there's always something busy that's driving a busy municipal agenda. And so just like most cities and towns, you know, our town runs 24/7. You know, we have police officers and firefighters and emergency response. We have community events. We had Memorial Day on Monday. We had, you know, a Pride event on Saturday. We have, you know, events every weekend coming up this summer. It is a busy job, but it's a job that I love, and it's an opportunity for us to really contribute to our civic life. But the world is in need of some changes, and, you know, we need to be more mindful, more thoughtful, more caring. We need to have leaders that understand that change to help people is in order. And I'm hoping that this small step can help us continue to evolve a culture that speaks of how much we care about people.
Sean Fitzgerald, stick with us for a moment, if you would. We're going to look at the bigger picture of this 4-day work week proposal now. On the line, we have Professor Juliet Shore. She's an economist and sociologist at Boston College here in town. Currently, she's overseeing a global experiment on the corporate 4-day work week. Thank you for joining us, Professor Shore.
My pleasure. Great to be here.
So it's important to note that in Swampscott, city employees are still working, but in fewer days, and their level of productivity has apparently not gone down. Your work specifically revolves around the 32-hour week. Give us a little context, if you would, of how we got to a 5-day work week in the first place.
Well, the U.S. was the first country globally to institute a 5-day week, and that happened in the early 20th century. We used to have we had a 7-day week and then a 6-day, and then we got to the 5-day week. There's a bumper sticker that, you know, probably makes the most important point about this, which is, you know, the trade unions, the group that brought you the weekend. So the 5-day, 40-hour week was enshrined in the Fair Labor Standards Act in 1938 during the New Deal and Depression as a way of dealing with the fact that we had so many unemployed people, and it was partially hoped that by restricting hours of work, companies would hire more people.
Okay, so that's thank you for going there, because 5 days seems like a lot, but it used to be 6 or 7 days. Let's talk about your work now. You've been running this global experiment since the start of the year with different companies from everywhere, from the U.S. to Australia and Ireland, and they're all instituting a 4-day work week for limited periods of time. What can you share with us in terms of how that's going?
So we've got companies, and I should also say nonprofits. Mm-hmm. We've got a really nice mix who are voluntarily sort of opting into 6-month trials. And the first trial started February 1st. We don't have final results from it, but we did get some preliminary results a couple of days ago on how it's affecting employees. And as we expected, we're seeing really nice improvements in people's stress, reductions in burnout scores, better physical health, mental health, more life satisfaction. One thing that I think is a big impact of the 4-day week that's probably not emphasized enough is sleep. Large numbers of people don't get enough sleep these days, and moving to a 4-day week actually gives them time for a bit more sleep. But I should also say our studies are a little bit more flexible. Our program is a little bit more flexible in that most of them are taking Fridays off, most of the companies, but there are a few that are doing things more like what the folks in Swampscott are doing, which is they're going to, a 34-hour week. Now, I realize they were already there, but it's not a very rigid one-size-fits-all that we're studying. So they've got a little bit of flexibility. We have a restaurant chain where managers, I think, started at 55 hours and they put them down into the low 40s. So as long as you're not cutting pay and you're reducing work significantly, we'd love to have you in the trial.
Okay. Well, I'm curious if you're hearing any feedback from these employees, managers. Do they feel that they're more efficient or do they feel like they're being crunched? I mean, to have to do the same amount of work in eight less hours over the course of a week, I imagine could be stressful for some.
Yeah, so I did. So we don't have any results from companies who, in the trial, who've done the full 6 months, but we have some companies who started early. And I did talk to employees in one of them about this. So the pace of work, I would say in the typical company, the pace of work can get a little more intense. Although a big part of what we coach companies on and help them to do is to reorganize work before they start. And in particular, we help them to deal with some of the low productivity or inefficient things they're doing. The biggest one is typically meetings.
Meetings.
If you can clear some of those meetings out, you make them shorter, more efficient, fewer people have to go to them. So to some extent, what's happening is you're taking things off people's plate. Right. So you're not just asking them to intensify by 20%. That won't work. You've got to reorganize work, and then you'll see a bit of that. So at HealthWise, the company I've looked at most in depth, they'll talk about how they may go from making phone calls to messaging people just because they can do that a little bit more quickly in the day they're in the office. People also talk about not wasting time. You know, some of these folks, you know, might be on Facebook or other things. And then doing personal things like doctor's appointments on the off day. That's a very consistent theme, and it's a way that the company can, you know, sort of get back some of that time and make it feasible. But people much prefer to have, as I say, they prefer a whole day off to snippets of time within a day.
Okay. We'll take that into account. Sean Fitzgerald, Swampscott Town Administrator, I want to bring you back in here as we pivot to another dynamic at play, and that's family time. So Megan Keeney-Anderson is Chief Marketing Officer at the Wanderlust Group. They're a startup that instituted a four-day work week starting on Tuesdays back in July of 2020. This is her speaking on a panel about the four-day work week earlier this year, addressing a benefit that many of us parents can probably appreciate.
I have, not everybody at my company is a parent, but I've got a four-year-old daughter, and my work weeks are chaotic and busy and at the max. And then I get to the weekend and it's just mom, mommy, mom, all weekend long. And so my weekends aren't relaxing. I don't get to think on my weekends. So Monday, when my daughter is, you know, in childcare and work is off, that's really my time to reflect, think, kind of lightly plan for the week. And then, as I said before, I end up hitting Tuesday really, really strong.
Sean, I'm giving you the last word real quick in 10 seconds. Since you launched this, do you feel that your employees have used their extra day in similar ways?
I do. I think we also gave every town employee a beach pass. So I expect this summer you'll see a lot of town employees enjoying themselves at the beach.
Well, that's Sean Fitzgerald, town administrator in Swampscott, and Juliet Shore, economist and sociologist at Boston College. Thanks so much for joining us.
Our pleasure.
That's our show for today.